This is episode 182, recorded October 14th, 2013.
Greetings, Aquamaxers!
Hello again!
Maybe I'm speaking too loud. Well, we'll try it, see what happens.
Okay. You're just being enthusiastic.
Okay.
We have several people today, so that's good. We have Dr. Bob's from Boston. We had his message last week, but we didn't have time to get to it, so we're going to start with that one.
Right.
And then we have Tom in Provo, and Tony in New York, and Steve in Lincoln, Nebraska. Is that the same Steve from before?
Yeah, okay. It is.
And
that should say Roger. I just fixed that.
I was trying to figure what Roger means.
No, I fixed it a minute ago. What happened?
We're looking at our notes on his
iPad.
Got it
unfixed somehow.
Okay. Roger in Maine. Is that new? Is Roger new?
He has contributed, but it's been a while.
Okay.
Been a while.
And Mick in Carnforth.
Yes, UK.
Yes, as opposed to Carnforth, Louisiana.
Okay.
I don't think there's one in Louisiana, really. I'm just being facetious.
I know, because you just don't like to say UK for some reason.
I figure everybody knows where Mick is from by now. Okay. Oh, but before we start on that, Field Recorder Fund is up to $60, so yay! And thank you very much.
So please keep going. Keep contributing.
Yes,
we need it.
I like it very much. Okay, shall we go to Dr. Bob?
Yes.
And he starts out saying, your comments about the North Shore of Boston and the South Shore were spot on. Outside of the city limits of Boston proper are the North and South Shore areas in Metro West. The North Shore extends north up toward the border of New Hampshire, and the South Shore extends south toward Cape Cod Canal. The regional comparison is much like the old east side and west side of New York City. Whose side is the best side?
So you were kind of joking, but you were actually right.
I guess so. Sometimes I'm right, and it's surprising. Okay. He says, my research for my new tank took two forms this past week. First was the biotope research, and second was the setup research. I took a field trip to a local pond, which would be my primary collection site to survey the species of flora and fauna. I tested samples of the water using my master test kit to get a baseline of the water type I would need to reproduce. Next, I noted the pond substrate and vegetation while I used a minnow trap to check the fish species in the shallows of four different locations. The substrate is a combination of mud, sand, and gravel. The three most common small plants are tuberous water lily, hornwort, and white stem pondweed. I am using the common names to spare you from having to read the scientific names. You're too kind. In each of these locations, I caught only one fish species, banded sunfish. And then he does put the scientific name in, for which he also apologizes. But let me do my best. Aneacanthus obesus?
That's pretty close, yeah.
What would you say?
Well, everybody says it their own way, you know.
Okay, well, I'll say it like Italian.
Yeah.
I know that they're okay.
Yes.
Bass.
Yes.
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 Because they're not playing the instrument.
Right.
Okay, they're bass, pickerel, perch, and other large species of sunfish in the pond, but I suspect this late in the season they are larger than the opening of the minnow trap, which is fine by me. The banded sunfish grows to only 3 inches, and my research shows it is one of the easiest native freshwater species to keep, since it will readily accept most food types and tolerates less than ideal water quality. The NANFA website suggests that chilling the water is only necessary if one desires to breed them.
Cool.
Did we do an interview once with somebody about sunfish?
Pumpkin seed sunfish, yeah.
Pumpkin seed sunfish.
Where's Carlos?
In New York. Right, that's right.
Okay. Yeah.
Your comment about collecting laws in your state was an important one. In our area, you need a fishing license to collect any fish. Additionally, you cannot keep fish that are considered sport fish in an aquarium. My saltwater killies are considered bait fish, and so is the banded sunfish. So, for example, I would have to release any young perch I caught that were under limit. I could only keep them if I got a special grant from the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and they don't give them out readily.
So it works out nicely doing the banded sunfish, then.
Mm. So, I'm not sure I know how that connects to perch.
No, he's just saying he couldn't keep perch if he were to catch them.
Oh, but he can keep the sunfish.
Right.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't quite follow that. Okay. So now that I have my biotope, I moved on to planning my setup. I chose to use pea-sized gravel and sand, but no mud. I figured the maintenance on mud would be atrocious. That's probably true. I chose to collect and plant rooted plants of the species mentioned, which eliminates the use of the undergravel system.
Okay. I just wanted to interject here a little bit because I wanted to apologize for a couple of weeks ago. Dr. Bob asked about undergravel filters, benefits and disadvantages and so on. And I didn't respond very clearly. I just sort of touched on it. I mentioned
that... speaking specifically for this tank that he's putting up?
No, kind of in general, although he was referring to this tank too, just, you know, but in general, what are the pros and cons of undergravel filters? And I didn't really get into it. I talked about the out of sight, out of mind, because detritus gathers under there and people don't clean it. That's true, but there are a lot of other things. And he mentioned some of them in his message here, like rooted plants don't do very well.
With undergravel?
With undergravel, right, because they've got that all that water moving around under there, and there are various processes that don't work as well for them. The substrate particle size is very specific. You were in a very tight range of particle size, so you can't be very creative with that. The substrate depth needs to be uniform too. When you're placing hardscape on top of substrate, you have to be careful not to actually put it on top of gravel, or you get dead spots and cause anaerobic patches. And then, of course, fish digging in it can be a problem too. There are lots of different things. And I didn't really talk about very many of them, so I apologize, but those are a few more.
Well, if that was a couple weeks ago, that's probably when you were sick.
Could be. But let's go back to Dr. Bob and what he's talking about. So
okay.
Why don't you continue with that?
He says, I will also be keeping the banded sunfish, as these are very attractive little fish, much like some of the cichlids. I do not, however, know if I want to introduce pond snails and crayfish. Each has their unique problems in an aquarium environment. Pond snails will quickly multiply and become a nuisance, numbers and consumption of plants. Crayfish will grow to be a menace to small fish. Maybe I need to consider being less of a purist on this matter. After all, I'm not collecting my substrate from the pond. I can't even imagine all the problems that would bring with it. So maybe a cleanup crew can be brought in from another country. I'll have to think on that first, because the crew would need to be happy in an unheated tank, and most inverts and the local fish store are not tolerant of temperatures that may fall to the upper 50s.
And even of the ones that are, a lot of them would probably be considered snacks by banded sunfish.
Mm.
Yeah, that's an interesting problem.
Did you have any suggestions?
Well, I agree with what he said about the crayfish. Also, they're definitely
algae crew
menacing. And I'm thinking about that one. Pond snails... Yeah, unless the sunfish eat some of the pond snails. I don't know if sunfish do or not, but if they did, that might help. If you're keeping the tank at a lower temperature, the pond snails wouldn't reproduce as quickly, probably, as they would in warmer water. But probably fast enough to cause a problem anyway, so...
What temperatures do assassin snails like?
They're tropical.
They're tropical.
Yeah,
okay.
So
they wouldn't work so well.
No, not if it's going to go down to the 50s.
My related research on water treatments and nitrifying bacteria led me to look at the empirical studies on the development of the bacteria species and the products that have been developed using these studies. The one brand that seemed to come out on top was Fritz Aquatics. They have several independent studies to back their Fritzyme product line. It's kind of fun to say Fritzyme product line.
Yeah.
With the prospect of shortening the tank cycling to under 2 weeks, I started the assembly of the tank. I have a black substrate of sand over gravel. I know they will be mixed eventually, but that doesn't bother me much. The depth is about 2 inches in the front, rising to about 5 inches in the back. And he mentions here also, as well, this is also a problem for undergravel systems.
Mm-hmm.
The plants are placed around the three sides with an open water area in the middle, much like the fish would encounter in the wild. I am presuming that with a well-planted tank and the fishless cycling using Fritzyme 7 and ammonia, the tank will be cycled by the beginning of next week. That means I can collect and stock my tank with sunfish well in advance of snow flying.
Okay. Well, hopefully it will work. There's just the thing that a fishless cycle and a good bacterial inoculant, like the one you're looking at, definitely help, but the temperature, right, it kind of depends too, the lower temperatures that you might have in that tank, bacteria, yeah, they take longer to reproduce, so it'll take longer to cycle. But if his tank is in the mid-70s, that's not too much of an issue right now, you know. It's usually...
This is just an idea. I don't know, would this... If he wanted to get it to cycle faster and the tank was already on the cool side, could he put a heater in before he puts the fish in just to get it to cycle faster and then take the heater out and let it cool back off?
That's what people do with fishless cycle sometimes.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It partly depends on what other species, if you've got plants and things in there already or not. But
okay.
It has been done. I've done it myself.
Oh. I'll bring
a tank up to 85, cycle it, and then bring it down.
There you go. I had
so
a
you had a good idea.
Idea.
You
Yay
did.
For me.
You have lots of good ideas.
Okay, so he goes on to say, I plan to start with just a small number, maybe 5 or 6, so I can get used to the requirements of these new residents. That also leaves room for top minnows or other types of locals later. I don't really want a single species tank.
Well, it sounds like, I love the fact that he's doing all this research ahead of time, going to the actual site where he's going to be collecting the fish and doing water tests, looking at substrate, looking at plant species. You know, it's cool. That's the way you need to do it. I wish we could all do that for all of our tanks. You know, if we're going to keep Southeast Asian fish, that we could
go to Southeast Asia.
But it's nice that since he's setting up native fish, that he can actually do it. Mm-hmm. You know, collecting local fish.
Sounds like a fun process.
Right.
He sent some updates as well.
Cool.
He says, my vermiculture is underway and the worms will arrive Monday. And he says, whatever that growth was on my red algae is gone, but so is the algae tissue in which it was attached. I have a feeling that the stuff consumed the algae.
Ew.
Yeek. I was noticing that my sand shrimp were disappearing, and then I noticed I had an unintentional intruder, Carcinus menas, a common littoral crab,
littoral.
As opposed to figurative. How do you say
littoral?
What does that mean?
It means like short area.
But in this context, what is it?
Shore area.
Oh, yeah. Shore.
Yeah, what did you think I said?
I thought you said short.
No.
And I'm like, what does that even mean?
Oh.
Shore area makes more sense. Okay. So, a common littoral crab called the green crab, which is an invasive species from Europe. The crab became fish food, which the Killies greatly appreciated. He says, I included a photo of one of the male Killies and one of the grass shrimp that can apparently defend themselves from crab predation. He says, well, this is a long one, but I like it when your shows are longer. I considered recording my letter to MP3, but I think the Aquamax listeners would... He's nice. I'll prefer to hear Kelly's voice over mine. That's very nice of you.
Well, I like to hear your mellifluous tones, but it's fun to hear other people, too. You're my favorite voice.
Oh, thanks. And he had a technical comment, too. He said, the volume balance between the two of you was off on your mics. It wasn't like the problem many shows ago, but it was quite noticeable, yes. And that is because our new computer, for whatever reason, will not let us use two mics, and so we're both using the same mic.
Well, the week he's talking about, we had both mics hooked up, but it wouldn't fully power the other one.
That's what the problem was. Yeah. That's why we're only using one now, because
right.
It won't make them the same volume.
It won't allow us to power them both completely. So
goofy,
that's why we need a field recorder, all the more reason.
Okay.
Yeah.
He says, so long, and thanks for all the fish, advice.
I love that.
And the dolphins say, you're very welcome.
That's it.
As long as you know where you're
Douglas Adams is. Reference, folks, if you missed that one.
Mm-hmm. You should have told
I didn't miss it.
They just have to get it to get their points.
Oh,
tell them they don't get
I got
it.
The point, then.
You got the points, okay. Okay, should we go to Tom in Provo?
Yes.
Okay. He says, in my tank, which is 36 gallons, I have 5 neon tetras, 6 harlequin rasboras, some orange swordtails, and he puts in parentheses for the orange pet shop color.
Yeah, the typical orange swordtails you find in pet stores.
And 4 mollies. I have a special place in my heart for mollies.
Yep, one of her favorites.
Yep. The 4 mollies, he says, 3 females that are quote-unquote fish-colored.
Which is a term you like to use.
Totally. Russ will ask me, what color is this fish? And I'll say, fish-colored. Fish-colored with some black specks and 1 male Dalmatian molly. For the most part, they seem happy with the water change. They swim around as if it were perfectly normal to have what you live in sucked down in plastic.
I like that phraseology there.
Well, we kind of do the same thing with air sucked in and out of vents and blown back out, and we don't give it a second thought, so...
True enough.
And then he says, except for 1 female molly. Every time I change the water, she seems very stressed. Tonight, after I'd taken about 2/3 of the water out, I noticed she seemed worse than usual. She was actually on her back at the bottom of the tank, hyperventilating. That poor fish needs some B vitamins or something. I assumed she was a goner, but by the time I had finished scraping algae, removing pond snails, and trimming java fern, I could not find her and realized she was up swimming around with her friends. That was about an hour ago. I have refilled the tank, and she seems fine. Have you observed this hyper-nervousness in individual fish before? Are mollies particularly nervous? Then he says, perhaps I should stop topping the tank off with Red Bull. But not, I don't really, honestly.
Yeah, so he doesn't really do that, but...
That's, oh, I don't... Is, Red Bull just in the US? I don't know. It's a nasty, nasty energy drink that's supposed to make you, like, uber caffeinated. Just in case, it, you know, they don't sell it wherever you're from. Which, yeah. If they don't, that's a good thing.
Okay, well, I hope we don't get nasty emails from Red Bull people.
Well, Red Bull can send as many nasty letters as they want because I don't like their stuff.
Okay, that's fine.
Is that a good enough reason?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, well, Tom wrote back shortly thereafter saying that the troubled Molly was now dead.
Oh, dear.
And I asked him some questions about pH and whether the water had outgassed and all that. Mm-hmm. And he said the pH in the tank is normally about 8 or 8.2, and so, but it was 8.4 at this time. Hmm. So it had gone up a little bit, but it's not a super, I mean, that's a big change, but it's not if it were like from 8.4 to 8.0 or 7.6, you know, something really big. Mm-hmm. He's not sure how recently that had happened. He's thinking it's been about a month or so since the pH had been up, and that's sort of a red flag, but I'm not sure exactly what's going on there.
She seems to be the only one that may be bugged by it.
Yeah, see, that's one thing. And he says the replacement water he uses from the tap through a python, so it's not already outgassed. Mm-hmm.
Is two-thirds too much to do it once, then?
Well, that is a question we're going to address more later in the podcast.
Oh, okay.
But not necessarily.
Jumping the water shame.
Not necessarily too much. Okay. But I asked him about the bubble formation, if he was getting, I mean, I asked him about outgassing. He says, well, you know, the water hasn't outgassed before, but he's not noticing a lot of bubbles forming in the tank, and that's a good sign. But maybe it's affecting the fish anyway, he says. And then he's careful with the temperature, because I mentioned that I had a couple of occasions when I wasn't being super careful, and I'd seen fish, you know, get shocked, and then the temperature's wrong, and I'd adjust it, and they'd be fine afterwards. But he always checks and puts his hand in there and confirms it's not too different, and this is the interesting thing, though. This is kind of a warning sign. He said the fish's stressed behavior always began after the tank was partially emptied, but before he began to add new water.
Hmm.
So it's not shock from anything in the new water. And then the fish died the next day, in this case.
What would make her stress out so much?
You know, this is a puzzler for me. It really is. I'm not sure what to say about this one.
Maybe she really did suffer from anxiety.
Maybe.
She was claustrophobic, and the water level would get too low, and she...
I don't know. I just didn't know where you were going with that one.
I'm not trying to be flippant. It just, you know, animals feel things too.
They do.
I'm just thinking of the poor little fish going, the sky is falling, you know.
Oh, well, I don't know what's going on. It's really confusing. Let's save Tony's voicemail till later, because it's going to be easier to fit to the end of the podcast. Okay. So let's do Tony's at the end.
So I don't know, have any of you guys had individual fish that would get stressed out?
Yeah, I don't know. If any of you have had similar issues before, let us know, because I haven't observed this particular thing. He did include a picture of the Molly, sent it to me. The Molly looked pretty good. It was dead, but other than being dead, it didn't look like it had any obvious, you know, physical ailments, as he mentioned.
He asked, are mollies in general kind of nervous and high-strung?
Well, they're a little bit more, how can I say? Their requirements are maybe a little bit more exacting than some of the other live bears, or, you know, but not so much. I mean, I wouldn't say they're nervous, no. In my experience, they've done well once they're, you know, acclimatized. Yeah. So
we just used two different forms of
the same word. We did. Okay, well, all hopefully right. Someone can shed some light on that one, because I'm afraid I can't do much.
We will kind of ponder that as well.
I have been, yeah.
Ideas come. We'll ponder some more.
Okay.
Okay, so we're going to go to Steve.
Steve in Lincoln, Nebraska.
That's a very cold place.
You're funny.
I know. Okay. I'm already cold.
It's okay.
Okay. He says, I just listened to episode 181. Was that last week?
Yep.
I guess it was. As you started talking about adding the donate button, I got excited as I knew you were talking about me. I didn't expect to be the first, and I hope it excites others to help you both with this awesome format. At the time, there were 180 episodes, and I have downloaded every single one. I listen to them at work every day. You guys are a riot at times while teaching on my favorite hobby. I have to say thank you for bringing up the heater recall, as I didn't know, and now have mine replaced. Good. Thank you for sharing that info. Yeah, I'm glad that was helpful. I have 5 tanks running now, and I enjoy it immensely. You will be hearing from me more in the future on topics. I am Steve from Lincoln, Nebraska. As someone famous once said, may the fish be with you. Well, welcome, Steve, and thank you again.
Yes, thank you again. And now, oh, you know what? We're bouncing back to Tom, because we have another contribution coming later.
Oh, we do?
That, on Tom? A somewhat different topic.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty. He says, I'm really pleased that at long last you've given a query. Oh, this is kind of the same topic. Mm-hmm. That's what you just said, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I don't remember where my brain is tonight. I feel
it's okay.
Flighty. Like I'm just going to fly out of my chair.
Okay.
And then your voice, okay, let's read the email. Okay, I'm really pleased that at long last you have given Aquarimaxers a more tangible way to contribute. May the support pour in and the field recorder be soon in your hands.
Oh, thank you. And thank you, Tom, for your support. Mm-hmm. Tom has helped us out as well. Mm-hmm. He has contributed in various ways, including to our fund. So, thank
you. Which we appreciate.
Yes.
Like many other questions, the question of the best volume and frequency of water changes does not seem settled or even settleable in the aquarium community. On a much earlier podcast, one of the contributors, I think it was Dave in Harlingen, Texas, referred to a 2-part article by David E. Borowczewicz. Sorry, I'm sure I butchered that. In the November and December 2009 issues of Tropical Fish, it's TFH.
Hobbyist.
Hobbyist, Tropical Fish Hobbyist.
Borowczewicz? I don't know.
Sorry, Mr. Borowczewicz. Strongly advocates very large water changes over small ones and demonstrates mathematically that 160% change does more to rid your tank of unwanted substances than 320% changes. At least I think he demonstrates it. The math seemed sound but made me a little dizzy. I totally get that. That's what math does to me too. As I remember, you did not respond to the article itself because there was a problem with the link. I created the links below, fully legally, I believe, from the share icon in the Tropical Fish Hobbyist Digital Edition, and hope they will work for you. If you have time to skim the article, I would be very interested in hearing your opinion, both from a theoretical and practical point of view.
All right. Well, let's delve into that a little bit. I've read the articles. Thank you for sending those. And I think it makes sense. I think the articles make sense. Basic idea, as the author describes it, I do recommend you all read it, and we'll try to put those links on the page for the show, but is that you say you have a tank with, we have a 10-gallon tank for the sake of the argument, keep it simple, right? And you have a certain amount of crud, as he calls it, in the tank, in the water, whatever, right? If you do a 10% change, you're leaving 90% of the crud in there. And then the next time you do a 10% change, that 90% crud is there, but a lot of more crud has built up again. So you do another 10% change. But really, you're not really making a dent in the crud, is the idea. The same is true with the 20% change. You're making a little bit more of a dent, but hardly at all. Because you have to, his point, you basically have to do a 60% change or more to significantly reduce the crud for any length of time.
I think I get that.
Yeah. And you have to do them fairly frequently.
Kind of like if you only do one load of laundry, it's not going to make any difference.
And the sound, I mean, in the wild, if you're in a body of water of any size, mm-hmm. Of any significant size, I should say, the fish are not dealing with the same water for very long, right? You have a fairly low bioload. In many bodies of water, there are exceptions to that, of course, but in general, like in the ocean, out in the coral reefs,
mm-hmm. everything's flowing in and out.
Yeah, and there's just very small amount of nutrients in the water, and that's one way to think of it. Or even in a river, water's constantly flowing by, and it's being replenished through rainwater and things like that. So the water is constantly changing, and of course, it's very good for the fish. Now there are small pools and things like that that don't have quite those same effects, but there are other things going on as well. At any rate, I think his math is sound. Makes sense to me. It.
You didn't get dizzy.
No, it made sense, and the idea that, how can I say this? From a practical standpoint, he addresses some of my concerns that I've had with large water changes. One of them being outgassing. I don't know that he addresses it completely to my satisfaction, but he does acknowledge that outgassing is an issue. And he says, when you do it, you need to really make the water boil. Like when you spray the hose into your tank, mm-hmm. aim it at the side of the tank and really jet it out there. And so agitate it as much as possible.
Does that get more, it makes more bubbles, so it's getting more gas out?
It outgasses more quickly.
Okay.
And, you know, I have tried to do that. And it also, he mentions that it does depend on the temperature of the water, and that's true. You get colder water, you're going to get more outgassing and so on.
Colder water has more gas in it?
Yeah, has more dissolved gas in it, and things like that. And how much pressure you have, you know, that the more pressure you have, the more outgassing you're going to get, different things like that. So he partially addresses that. And I would say that...
More outgassing being the bubbles leaving.
I mean, there's more gas in the water to worry about.
If you have higher water
pressure? Higher water pressure and lower temperatures, yes. It's going to be more of a problem.
Why, or will that take half an hour?
We don't need to worry really about why.
Okay.
But let's just take that as a given. But I think if I could, if I had time and if it were easy to do, I would like to do very large water changes with water of a chemistry that was good for the fish, right?
It's like you really prep the water beforehand so you don't have to worry about outgassing.
Right. And I would, you know, some people do flow throughs. And they do really well. I've known several people who do flow-throughs. The tropical fish wholesalers down in Draper, so halfway between our house and Tom's house,
yeah.
they have their whole system on a flow-through from warm springs. The water comes out of these warm springs just pretty much perfect temperature.
Mm-hmm.
It's good pH. All the water parameters are perfect for tropical fish of...
Nice.
Especially the ones that can handle, you know, harder water of a higher pH, like the African cichlids, that they have a lot of those. And that's what they do. They just do flow through all the time, constantly. All their tanks are on a flow through. And they do really, really well. And they don't ever have to change water because they're always changing water.
Right.
Nobody has to go around with a python and change water because they don't bother changing, cleaning the substrate very often, but they don't need to because the water's flowing.
It's flowing through and taking stuff away.
Right. And it works really well. If I could do a flow through like that, I would. I think it would be really, really beneficial. But in terms of practicality, it sometimes can be difficult, but I do agree that as long as you can address the issues. Right. Well, one thing, too, is that he says, well, one of the biggest arguments against doing these huge water changes is water chemistry issues, that if you make this change, it's going to shark your fish. And he says, well, do a whole bunch of water changes, and the chemistry will be closer to what's coming out of your tap in your tank than it will be to whatever it's becoming because of all these, you know, degradation processes that are occurring in your tank. So your fish don't really have to get used to anything because they're used to your tap water because you're doing so many water changes. Not tap water with the chlorine,
no,
of course. He's talking about treated tap water, obviously. But he's saying...
Different fish still, some of them just can't handle different kinds of tap water, though.
Right. I mean, if you have water that require really almost RO water and your tap water comes out liquid rock, then you really can't do that. Unless you have an RO unit and you use that to help compose your water. But... I think it makes a lot of sense. And the fact that, you know, on my tanks, it depends on the tank, but like the goldfish tank, I usually do 50. Sometimes I think, was it yesterday, I did 60, about a 60% water change. And I try to do that twice a week. And it's probably not enough, but it's a lot better than what a lot of goldfish get. And you have to find what works for you, but I think the more water changes, the better. Unless you have something like, you know, we were talking about Juliet in Paris, France, her issues with her shrimp. The tap water is causing some issues, and so she can't do a very big water change or she will kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some sensitive species that really just seem to react poorly to that kind of thing.
So So you have to take that into account.
You have to take that into account.
In general, you support his idea of bigger water changes.
Yeah, if you can take care of the outgassing, you make sure there's not a big pH swing when it happens. You make sure the water's appropriately treated for chemicals like chlorine and chloramine. That kind of thing. If you can handle all those, and then you keep the temperature. Did I already say temperature? I don't know. But if you can keep all those things from being too much of a shock, then I think it's good. Good thing.
Okay.
And I have done like 90% water changes on the goldfish tank without any problems.
And they've been fine.
They've been fine.
Well, there we go. Russ's official reaction to the article. Okay, we have Roger in Maine. He says, I have a problem with my TDS levels. That's total dissolved solids.
Very good.
Right? Yay, me! That little snack.
High five.
I have a problem with my TDS levels in my 55 freshwater aquarium. I recently made a mistake during a routine water change over the weekend. I accidentally used the wrong 10-gallon Rubbermaid container that is for my 75-gallon reef aquarium. I own two identical containers, one for salt and one for fresh. There must have been some undissolved salt left in the bottom of the container. I caught the mistake after the water change was completed and decided to immediately test. My freshwater tank's normal TDS is between 125 to 200 parts per million. After the water change, it drastically jumped up to 700 parts per million. The good news is all of the tank's inhabitants survived and appear to be in good health. They include 10 tiger barbs, 2 firemouth, a female albino convict, and 4 black coolie loaches. In addition, the aquarium is planted with Amazon swords, crips, java fern, and anubias. So his question is, will this hurt my plants and fish in the long run? The pH jumped from 6.3 to 7.8 almost instantly. I do not own a GH or KH test kit, but I'm sure they're off the charts now also. As you know, reef salt and aquarium salt are two completely different in their trace and mineral makeup. The brand of salt they use is made by Fluval C. Will these extra elements such as iodine, strontium, magnesium, and calcium kill off any freshwater bacteria? My ammonia and nitrate levels are... Did I say nitrate?
You said nitrate.
Okay. Nitrate levels are reading at undetectable as of this morning. Regardless, the only way to get these extra unwanted ingredients out of my tank is through water changes.
Once again, the water changes issue today. Yep.
We have a theme. It says, I'm planning on doing a 20% water change daily using RO or DI until levels normalize.
Okay. Well, that's probably a good plan because unlike the crud we were talking about earlier, it's not going to be constantly accumulating in his tank, so he can actually decrease it.
Producing more.
Right. Nothing adding more of those dissolved solids, well, in the amounts that he's talking about, to his tank. So 20% water change once a day will reduce it fairly quickly, and it will also help keep the pH from swinging too fast, because that was a huge swing,
that's
and it's
really
pretty amazing that his fish are doing that well. I'm glad they are. But to keep it from having to swing too fast again, I think that's probably a good way to do it.
So he said, will this hurt my plants and fish in the long run?
Probably not, unless the damage has already been done. I mean, it's possible that...
If they're doing okay at this point, then maybe they'll...
Hopefully. I mean, it could have weakened their immune systems, and they're not showing it, but typically if they're going to show effects from a wild pH swing, they'll get like pH burns that are even visible. You can see it. At least, at the very least, they're going to look stressed. The change like that. So if they seem to be doing okay, so far so good, hopefully.
So he says at the end, lesson learned, mark your containers and buckets.
Yeah, it's always a good idea.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Roger, and welcome back. It's been a while.
Keep us posted. Hopefully they'll do okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Mick. Mick says, I was really encouraged to hear Russ talking about some of the issues with micro and Walter worms recently. I've had struggling cultures for months now. Lots of wrigglers in the media, but no migration up the sides of the culture tub to harvest. As a result, I have lost quite a number of fry to nothing else but starvation, including my recent spawn of Corydoras sterbi, which I am quite disappointed with. I tried adding extra ventilation following Russ's advice, but alas, no improvement. In fact, one culture tub seemed to get infested with tiny white mites. I sometimes get this on grindle worms, but these were much smaller. The mites were smaller?
Sounds like the mites were smaller, yeah. Hmm. They weren't jumping, were they?
I don't know. He doesn't say.
Because, I know grain mites can get into a microworm culture, but it seems like it would have to be a pretty dry one that I've ever seen. They bug grindleworm cultures like crazy, the grain mites, but this must be something different.
Maybe it's something that we don't have here.
Or it might be, or it might be something else that's not a mite. I don't know. If you can explain how they move or something, that might be cool. They might be too small to get a picture of. But
yes, that's probably true. Said, I bought a new culture from a recent club auction, thinking it was just my old one, which had become run down for some reason. The new culture looked good, but 2 days later, no worms to harvest. So I got a culture which was really productive from a friend, and 2 days later, no worms again. So I decided to bring one of the cultures into the house rather than leave it in the fish room, and hey presto, lots of worms to harvest. So I have brought all my worm cultures into the house, micro and grindle, and am now getting much better results. The average temperature in my fish room is around 24 to 26 degrees Celsius, and I have always had good results in the past culturing them in there. Do you think it is temperature related, or could there be something else going on? The humidity in the fish room holds fairly steady at 60 to 70%. So, and this is in quotes, my meddlesome microworms make more merriment in the house. He says, a shameless plug for the much coveted Aquarium Mix alliteration award, I know.
Which I think he has won.
Good, yeah.
I think he won that today. Yeah.
That this time. Should I say it again?
Yeah.
My meddlesome microworms make more merriment. That's good.
It is. I like that.
So what are you thinking about temperature and humidity?
Well, there are several things that affect it, and like we were talking about before, it really is a balancing act. They might actually be getting too much ventilation. That will sometimes do it, because if you notice a culture that doesn't have much worm activity, and that's why they're not climbing, but there's not what much worm activity on the surface of the actual medium,
mm-hmm.
that usually means that the CO2 has killed them.
Then they need more
ventilation. They didn't get enough ventilation, or they had too much yeast or something like that to kill them off. But he was saying that they're active on the surface.
But they're not crawling.
That sometimes can either be, well, it can either be too much ventilation, which means they don't need to climb because they're getting plenty of oxygen down there.
Okay.
It's one possibility. It could also be that they have the cooler temperatures will, which doesn't sound like what's going on in his case, cooler temperatures will also, they'll have enough oxygen because their metabolisms are lower. They don't need as much oxygen, so they don't climb. But it sounds like he's looked into all of these, and none of those things seem to be affecting it except for coming in the house, which is puzzling. But hey, he's found something.
That's good. He said, just as a quick add-on, following the advice from a fellow fish club member, I now culture all my micro-type worms on a slice of bread. Just dampen with a spray mister, add a spoonful of culture, and away you go. No mixing porridge oats or such, and the cultures usually are harvestable within a few days. There's another quick add-on. It's a bit like Peter Falk in Columbo. This, just one more thing, sir. Kelly can do, oh, but I can do the voice too, except I missed Columbo. My mom watched it. I remember her watching it really liking it. I just remember this guy in a trench coat.
Yeah.
So I don't know the voice. I'm sorry.
He's the same guy in Princess Bride.
Oh.
The grandfather.
Okay. All right.
Uh-huh.
Fencing, fighting, true love.
Miracles,
that guy?
Yeah.
Okay, now, just one more thing, sir. One more thing. Is that better?
I don't know.
I've never ever seen it. I'll have to look it up. I was serving a customer in the shop last week when they said, do you know you have some little neon tetras in your plant tank? I took a look, and to my amazement, there were 5 very tiny neon tetra-looking fish. Took a closer look later that day to realize they were white cloud minnow fry. Is that just a slightly different name for what you had, the white cloud mountain minnows?
Yeah.
Okay.
Same fish.
They must have been eggs that came in on the last delivery of plants, which somehow survived being dry packed and shipped for 3 days, and also survived the plant take being cleaned with cold raw tap water and treated with an anti-snail product. So they're very hardy, I guess, huh? I netted the tenacious little bladders out, and they are now growing on a treat in the fish room, feeding on the microworms, which have started to produce just in time. That's
yeah,
fun.
It is. One thing, I've heard of the bread method. I've never tried it. I've tried several media for microworms. Never tried the bread method, but I might do that sometime if we have some stale bread or something. We'd never go stale in our house. Our kids eat it before it's... Yeah.
Two teenage boys and nothing goes and
two girls who also eat bread, and yes. I eat bread, and you can't eat bread. But
I can't eat bread.
But with 5 people who eat bread, anyway, we never get a chance to have stale bread. But the thing about the white cloud mountain minnows, the stories that are circulated about their collection, apparently they live in quite cool water in the wild. So the cold tap water is not so much of a surprise. The raw tap water, that is more of a surprise. And the fact that the eggs were able to delay hatching while they were sitting there. I mean, when he says dry packed, he means that they're not in standing water, but the plants, of course, were still damp.
They wrap them in something like newspaper.
Well, you know, when I've shipped plants, I just ship them in a bag, usually, and the plants stay there with a few drops of water, but the humidity in the bag is really high, and it wouldn't desiccate the eggs. But the fact that they didn't hatch until then is interesting. Unless maybe they just dripped down into that little part and the little bit of water in the bag and were hanging out in there. I don't know.
Maybe. How big are their eggs?
They're small. Teeny, tiny. Like head of a pin size. Oh, yeah. Maybe smaller than that. A little smaller than that. Hmm. Yeah, they're quite small. But they do adhere to the plants, usually. And they are really easy to breed. And tough little fish.
I guess that makes sense.
I mean, they were either the first or second egg layer I ever bred. They're fun little creatures. And when they're babies, they do look a lot like neon tetras, more so than when they're adults. They're very bright, very vivid as they're young. And as they get older, they tend to change color. So they're still beautiful, but the color is further removed from neon tetras. When they're little, they really look a lot like neon tetras. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of a fun surprise then.
Yeah.
Alrighty, I think that's everything for tonight.
Nope. There's Tony. Tony in New York.
We have to put his voicemail in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's awesome, and I now cast my official vote that when we get t-shirts up and running, one of them has a picture of like a pair of Aquarimax colored glasses, a lensed glasses, whatever. See the world through the lens of Aquarimax. That's awesome. I love it.
And I think, Tony, you've hit an interesting point, because we were talking a little bit about heat and nutrients in episode 181 in the context of gel foods, and I think it's interesting that you should mention the juice fast and how they say not to get a cheap blender, for the reason that you'll get the hot blender will destroy the nutrients. But I think you hit the nail on the head, that any nutrients that would be destroyed by the hot blender are probably going to be damaged by the hot gelatin mixture. So,
although, I mean, there's always the, not everything gets killed every time, so you might as well kill as few of them each time as you can.
That's a very good point, too. You're going to lose some from heat, but why lose even more from heat?
Right.
So, if you can afford a good blender for your gel food.
That would be dedicated to chopping up shrimp and
stuff.
Stuff that you don't want in your own smoothies.
Right. Then it's probably worth doing. I don't think we could ever get away with putting that sort of stuff in our blender, though.
No, I would be very sad. You know, celery and spinach are enough to put into smoothies.
Yeah.
That sometimes make it taste funky. I should know.
Yeah. So, it's a good point that you bring up, though.
And feel free to call in Muse anytime.
Feel free to what?
Muse. He said he was musing on the Aquarimax line.
Oh, right.
Feel free to muse.
Yeah, we like that.
Yeah.
It was some good musing. Mm-hmm. So, well, I think that's about all for this week, isn't it?
I think so, and we went over, but you probably don't mind so much.
Hopefully not.
Someday you may not mind so much.
So may the fish
be with you.